Well, if you'll turn in your Bibles again to the second book of Samuel and chapter 9. I don't know how old you are. I know how old some of you are, but most of you, if you ask me your age, I couldn't tell you. So this will only apply to some from a certain age. But I don't know whether you remember the famous BBC TV series Blake 7. I think that Blake 7 is the greatest TV show ever to have graced a small screen. Now, young people, if you've never heard of Blake 7, then YouTube it. It's fantastic, and you should really give it a go. But if you were to turn on to Blake 7, just at any random episode, maybe one from series 2 or something like that, you'd be hooked in minutes because it's great. But I think also there would be a sense of confusion. You wouldn't know who the characters were. You wouldn't know who was good, who was bad. You wouldn't know exactly what was going on. And although you would enjoy the episode, there would also be that sense that because you hadn't watched it from the beginning, you wouldn't really understand fully what's going on. And the same is true when we come to 2 Samuel in chapter 9. Before we can understand what is going on, we have to understand a little bit of the history behind this chapter, a little bit of the background that underpins this chapter. So we begin in verse 1. We read, "Now David said, 'Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?'" And yet the question obviously arises, well, who is Jonathan? Who is Saul? Who is David? To some of us, this may be familiar, but to others of us, we may be coming to this chapter and we may be thinking, why is David looking to bless someone from the house of Saul for Jonathan's sake? So let's just get a bit of the background. David here in chapter 9 is king. He is king of all Israel. Now, most people who are kings are the sons of a king. Most kings have come from a royal family. And yet David was different. His father wasn't a king. David was no prince. David was a mere shepherd boy. And yet in the first book of Samuel, in chapter 16, we read that the prophet Samuel goes to David and anoints him as God's chosen king. Now at the time, the man on the throne is King Saul. And of course, by David being anointed king, this meant that Saul, as well as Jonathan, Saul's son, would lose their entitlement to the throne. Saul, therefore, hated David. Saul was jealous of him. He could see that the Lord was with David, and yet the Lord was not with Saul. And therefore, Saul, on several occasions, attempted to take the life of David. And you would expect, of course, that if Saul hated David because he was the anointed king, you would expect, therefore, that Jonathan, Saul's son, would also hate David. And yet the truth is very different. Rather than Jonathan, Saul's son, hating David, Jonathan loved him. David and Jonathan's relationship was not one of hatred, it was one of friendship. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 18, "Now when he," that's David, "had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul." So David and Jonathan, two men who in any other setting, two men whom if they didn't love God would have been the most natural of enemies. And yet these two men both love God, and because they love God, they love each other. Even though David will inherit the throne, that Jonathan could feel rightly belonged to him. And we see that actually Jonathan was quite willing that David should take the throne. We read a few verses on from the verse I just read. We read, "And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David, with his armour, even to his sword and his bow and his belt." Jonathan gave David his official garments to signify that he had accepted that David was the chosen king. What love this man Jonathan had. And yet Jonathan did ask David to take an oath. Jonathan asked David that when he became king, that David would show kindness to Jonathan's descendants. He made David promise, "You'll show kindness to my children and my children's children." And David, of course, promised that he would. So there we have it. David and Jonathan, two men who would naturally hate each other because of their positions, and yet they both love God. And because they both love God, they love each other. They love each other as brothers, because they are brothers, not physically, of course, but they're brothers in the Lord. And that's what we see in God's people, isn't it? Enemies become brothers. If you're familiar with the 12 disciples, you'll know that one of the disciples was called Matthew, or Levi, and his job was that of a tax collector. Another one of the disciples was called Simon, and he was known as Simon the Zealot. Well, the Zealots were a particular terrorist group in Israel. The tax collectors worked for the Romans who were occupying Israel at the time, and therefore the Zealots would find tax collectors and they would kill them. They hated each other, they despised each other, and yet, when Matthew and when Simon came to know the Lord, these two enemies became friends. They became brothers. That's what the love of God does. And that's what the love of God did for David and Jonathan. So, we arrive at 2 Samuel and chapter 9. And David says, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Well, what's happened? Where is Saul? Where is Jonathan? Well, they're both dead. And there is only one person who remains. In verse 3, verse 2 even, and we read, "There was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So they called him to David, and the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' He said, 'At your service.' Then the king said, 'Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?' And Ziba said to the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet.'" So Jonathan and Saul are dead. And yet, Ziba says, there is a son of Jonathan, but he's lame in his feet. And that's why, of course, we read 2 Samuel in chapter 4, verse 4. If you turn to it again, that might be useful. We read, "Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened, as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame. Saul the king and Jonathan, the official heir to the throne, have both been killed in battle." And so news comes to those who are caring for Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. And they get up and they flee. Why do they flee? Well, the answer's quite clear. In that if Saul is king and if Jonathan is the official heir to the throne, then the next in line for the throne is 5-year-old Mephibosheth. And therefore anyone power hungry who wants to seize the throne, all they need do is take Mephibosheth's life. If they get Mephibosheth out of the way, then they can be king. And therefore, as soon as Saul and Jonathan, Saul's son, are dead, Mephibosheth's life is in great danger. So you can understand why Mephibosheth's nurse ran. His life was now in danger, and so was hers. But you know how it is. You're in a rush. You're trying to carry several things at once, and you drop something. Well, Mephibosheth's nurse dropped Mephibosheth. Now, when I was at school, I had a mate called George, and he was a nice enough fella, but his dad, when he was, I'm not sure exactly what job he did, but he was 20 foot up a ladder at one point. And I think, apparently, one of the runs on the ladder broke. And that having broke, it kind of caused a chain reaction. As he fell onto the next run, that one broke, and then it broke, and it broke, and it broke. And George's dad fell the whole way down this ladder and landed on his feet. That caused the ankle bones and the bones in his feet to completely shatter. And George's dad couldn't walk anymore. Well, we don't know what Mephibosheth's injuries were. Maybe the bones in his feet were shattered. Maybe he fell on his spine. Something happened, though, and as Mephibosheth fell, he became lame. He was unable to walk. Now, if being unable to walk is difficult enough in our day and age, how much more must it have been difficult in the year 1000 BC? So Mephibosheth is disabled, and he's on the run. And now, in chapter 9, we read David asking, is there anyone left? How many years have passed? Well, apparently, roughly 16 years have passed since Saul died in battle. And that makes Mephibosheth 21 years old. So for 21 years old, he has been living as a paralyzed man. And yet, where has he been living? Well, verse 4, we read, so the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lo-debar. Well, where is Lo-debar? Lo-debar is in a place called Gilead. And Lo-debar means pastureless, which means that it's a wilderness. There's nothing in Lo-debar that grows. Lo-debar is an inhospitable place. It is a horrible place to live. No one would take their summer holidays in Gilead or in Lo-debar. I don't know if you ever watch Location, Location, Location. Often in my house I'm forced to. But apparently at last year, Middlesbrough was voted by Location, Location, Location to be the worst place to live in the whole of the UK. There were various reasons, crime and drug abuse and fair reasons, I suppose, for why it wouldn't be a very nice place to live. Well, I suppose if there happened to be a location, location, location for the promised land in 1000 BC, Gilead and Lo-debar would have been on the top 5 list of where not to live. No one wanted to live in Gilead. It was a horrible place. Nothing grew there. There were sharp and jagged rocks all over the place. There were wild animals running free. It was like Middlesbrough. It was a horrible place to live. And so you have to ask yourself, what is Mephibosheth doing there? Why is the son of a prince in such a place as Lo-debar? Well, firstly, Whereas Saul, his grandfather, the king, had lots of land and lots of servants, all of that land and all of those servants have been inherited by David. So Mephibosheth is staying in someone else's home, isn't he? We read, and Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodabar. Mephibosheth has no home of his own. All of his land that should have belonged to him was inherited by David. And secondly, why is Mephibosheth in Lodabar? Well, Mephibosheth is on the run, just as he had been 16 years previous. We don't know how much his nurse knew of the relationship between David and Jonathan. But it's quite likely that they feared that David would want to take the life of Mephibosheth. Now, why do we say that? Well, look a few verses down. We read in verse 6, now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. Then David said, Mephibosheth? And he answered, here is your servant. So David said to him, do not fear. Mephibosheth comes before the king and he prostrates himself. What does this mean? Is this just Mephibosheth bowing to the king? No. This is Mephibosheth throwing himself on the floor before David. And that's not something for a disabled person to do. That's not an easy thing for a disabled person to do, is it? To throw themselves on the ground. Mephibosheth is obviously petrified that his life is about to be taken. And therefore, David says, do not fear. There's no need to fear, Mephibosheth. Your life isn't in danger. Maybe Mephibosheth hopes that by throwing himself on the floor before David, by showing David that he's a lame man and that therefore he's of no threat to the throne, then maybe he hopes that David will simply have pity and simply have mercy. Mephibosheth comes before the king, not realizing that David hasn't sought him out in order to kill him, in order to take his life. No, David has sought him out to bless him. But Mephibosheth, he doesn't notice, does he? As far as he knows, he is the official heir to the throne, and therefore his life is in danger. And as far as he knows, this King David seeks to take his life so that he can get rid of this rival heir. So I suppose as we've looked at Mephibosheth, we've really seen a sad figure, haven't we? He's paralyzed. He has no home to call his own. And he lives a life of constant fear of his life being taken simply because of the family he came from. And yet, what do we find David says? We find in the end of verse 6, we see, David said, Mephibosheth, and he answered, here is your servant. So David said to him, do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. If Mephibosheth came before David expecting the worst, he actually receives the best news he could have ever heard. We read firstly, I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather. So that land that Mephibosheth had lost will be restored. That inheritance that was once rightfully his will be restored to him. It will be given back. And yet, it actually gets far better than that. Because whereas before, Mephibosheth was simply the son of a prince, well now, Mephibosheth will be treated as the son of a king. We read, don't we? I will restore to you all the land of Saul your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. And verse 11 we read, and as for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. So not only has the inheritance that Mephibosheth lost been restored to him, but also Mephibosheth has been adopted into the family of King David. He will now be treated as one of the king's sons. In a sense, the blessing that he enjoyed through receiving the land of Saul will pale into comparison with being treated as one of the king's sons and living in the palace. So Mephibosheth comes before David, expecting his life to be taken, and yet he's given a completely new life. He is given blessing beyond all measure. And how does Mephibosheth react to this news? Well, verse 8, we read, then he bowed himself and said, what is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I? I suppose apparently in the UK we're animal lovers, aren't we? And dogs are often known as a man's best friend. I often feel that dogs are my enemies. I can't stand them. But dogs are particularly loved in our country, aren't they? And therefore a dead dog isn't something to be is something to be mourned. A dead dog is an animal to be buried, an animal to be cared for. In fact, I was looking on the internet this week, and if you own a large dog and you need to bury your dog, if you want a traditional solid oak coffin, it will set you back £339. And if you want a headstone with a colour picture inset, it will cost you £241. So to bury a big dog in the UK can cost you £580. Well, we love animals in the UK, don't we? And therefore people are prepared to pay that for their dog. And yet in Israel, of course, things were very different. In Israel, dogs weren't a man's best friend. In Israel, dogs were a pest. They were a menace. Just a few verses to show that. Later on in the book of 1 Kings, there was a wicked king. He was called King Ahab. And King Ahab was struck by an arrow whilst in his chariot, and he died in his chariot. And we read, then someone washed the chariot at a pool in Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Jezebel, his wife, who was a very nasty piece of work, she was thrown out of a window, and then she was run over by a chariot. And we read, so they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. Well, what had happened to Jezebel? Well, it had been prophesied that her body would be eaten by the dogs. Dogs were scavengers. Dogs were pests. No one loved a dog in Israel. No one would give a dog a funeral or a burial. In fact, the best way I suppose you could describe it is the same way that we feel about foxes. I heard a few weeks ago that after those foxes attacked those little babies, that people were actually getting sausages, raw sausages, and putting Panadol inside them so that the foxes would eat them and kill them. I'm not saying you should do that by any means, but just something occurred to me. We can't stand foxes in London, especially, can we? They're pests. They're a menace. And when you're driving along the A316 on the way home and you see a flat fox on the road, you don't care about it. It's nothing. Well, that's the same way that people felt about dogs in Israel. Dogs were nothing. And therefore, when Mephibosheth says, in verse 8, when he says, What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I? What is Mephibosheth saying? He's saying, I'm nothing. Why would you, king, show me such love? Why would you treat me so kindly when I am nothing? I'm just like a dead dog. And yet this dead dog, this nobody, this Mephibosheth, who came before the king in fear of his life, is now being blessed beyond all measure. Mephibosheth, who was poor, now has land and servants. Mephibosheth, who lived in the wilderness, now lives in the palace. Mephibosheth, who lived in fear of the king, now lives in the palace as one of the king's sons. Do you see what a difference the kindness of King David made in his life? Well, I suppose as we read this, we might think to ourselves, well, what's this all about? Why is this story, this event, why is it recorded in the Bible? We all love it. We all have a rags to riches story, don't we? Think of Oliver Twist or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Cinderella. We love rags to riches stories, don't we? And is that all this is? Is this just an ancient Israeli rags to riches story? Well, no, it's far more than that. Verse 3, what do we read? Then the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? David was seeking to show the kindness of God. And if the kindness of David, a man after God's own heart, as he is described, is so immense and so astounding, how much more astounding and how much more amazing and how much more jaw-dropping must the kindness of God himself be? If David's kindness was immense, then God's kindness far outweighs it. And actually, in this chapter of 2 Samuel and chapter 9, we actually see a wonderful picture of the kindness of God. We see a wonderful picture of the gospel of sinners brought to their God and blessed beyond measure. Think of Mephibosheth for a moment. Mephibosheth falls. And having fallen, he became lame. And in fear of the king, he hides away in the wilderness. And being found by the king, he is summoned to stand before him. And yet he does not receive the death sentence he is expecting. David instead restores to him the inheritance that he lost. And Mephibosheth is brought into the palace to sit at the king's table as one of the king's sons. Well, Mephibosheth shows us something of ourselves, doesn't he? He shows us something of the state that we are in. And he shows us how God shows grace and mercy and love to sinners. Just like Mephibosheth, we are a fallen human race. When Adam ate of that fruit in the Garden of Eden, he fell and we fell with him. And having fallen, the human race, and that's you and I as included in this, we have become lame. We have become spiritually paralyzed, completely unable in and of ourselves to please God. Just as Mephibosheth could not stand and walk, so we cannot please God. We are spiritually lame, spiritually paralyzed. And of course, being spiritually paralyzed, we are cut off from God. And just as Mephibosheth dwelt in the wilderness, so we dwell in a spiritual wilderness. We are separated from him, and we live in fear of him. And of course, if we leave this life in that state, we will spend eternity separated from God. Eternity completely removed from all the love and the grace and the mercy of God. And yet, just as Mephibosheth was in fear of the king, and just as for Mephibosheth, the last thing he would have ever considered was to seek out David for himself, David went looking for Mephibosheth. And so God has come looking for us. This God came looking and made the first move for people like you and me. People who are spiritually paralyzed. And he called us to him. Just as Mephibosheth was called to the throne of David, and he came in fear and trembling, well, God calls us to his throne. And yet, just like David, God doesn't call us to condemn us. He doesn't call us to carry out that death sentence that we fear. God calls us to bless us. And all those who have come to Christ, just as Mephibosheth, they receive that inheritance, don't they? They are restored. They gain the riches of Jesus Christ. And furthermore, they are adopted. John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 12 says, "But as many as received him," that's Christ, "to them he gave the right to become children of God." To those who have come to know Jesus Christ as their Saviour, they have been adopted into the King's family. Not an earthly king, but the real King, the King of Kings. They have come into his family and have become the children of God. And so do you see, friends, as we look at Mephibosheth, and as we look at his awful situation turned into a wonderful situation of blessing and joy, we actually see ourselves, don't we? Those of us who know Jesus Christ as our Saviour, we can agree with Mephibosheth when he says, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I?" We can see where Mephibosheth's coming from. I'm a sinner. I'm nothing. Why would the God of heaven and earth, why would the King of Kings and Lord of Lords save me? Why would he come looking for me and call me when I am such a sinner, when I am nothing? We can stand with Mephibosheth and we can be amazed, can't we, at the kindness that has been shown to us. And yet, friends, there are, of course, some here tonight, and you can't say that. You can't say that you've received the kindness and the blessing of God. Because like Mephibosheth, you've remained in that spiritual wilderness. And you're still spiritually paralyzed. And you're still living in fear of the king. And yet, friends, what did David say? He said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And maybe God says tonight, "Is there anyone in Amiens Park Chapel to whom I can show the kindness of God?" And just as David said, "Mephibosheth, do not fear," maybe God calls you by your name tonight. And he says, "Don't be afraid. I'm not calling you in judgment. I'm not calling you to punish you. I'm calling you to come to me and to become part of my family, to become one of the children of God. Friends, tonight, God calls you. Just as David called Mephibosheth, he calls you. And he says, turn from your sin. Leave that spiritual wilderness and come to me. Become part of my family. Come into my house. Spend eternity sitting at the king's table. Well, friends, will you come tonight? God calls you. Jesus has died. Jesus has risen. The price has been paid. Will you come?